I want to thank everybody for coming out, and for the SJP and other folks, and Andy Thayer and others who worked so hard to organize this event. It's a great honor to be here. I'm going to speak broadly about my situation with the University of Illinois, and I hope to put it sort of in a broader context of academic freedom and related matters. And there's a lot to unpack in my termination from the University of Illinois. The first thing we must realize is that my situation is not exceptional. We are all affected by it. In the boardrooms and classrooms, as well as in the STEM fields, arts, humanities, social sciences, physical plants, and student affairs. Those effects bode well for few other than the corporate elite and the well-heeled commentariat. Before I say anything about Palestine and the University of Illinois, let me first acknowledge that what happened to me has been happening to ethnic, sexual, and cultural minorities in academia for decades, African Americans especially, and it continues to happen today. A shameful irony is that Jews were long marginalized in the academy because of their supposed dangers to Anglo civility, victim to rationalizations for their exclusion that sadly don't look terribly different than the ones now being used against supporters of Palestinian human rights. So I want to honor those before and alongside me, and those in the future on whose behalf we struggle for a better world. A friend and one of my intellectual heroes said of academic freedom, "It was never for us anyway." Any cursory review of the history of American universities proves this observation true. The suppression of blackness and indigeneity predates the purge of Palestine and in many ways contextualizes and sustains it. The regulation of deviant bodies, ideas, and identities has influenced American campuses since their inception. With some exceptions, the ethos of the university as a site of special intellectual dispensation came into existence based on exclusion. My situation makes no sense outside of this context. Nothing in academia makes sense at the level of individuality. We are in it together, whether or not we want to be. Why then has my case received such attention? It's not an easy question to answer, because much of it has to do with unquantifiable factors like timing and the mood of the zeitgeist. Some answers do exist, however, which I believe illuminate important things about the state of speech in universities today. First, the university's decision was egregious. Even folks generally uninterested in academic freedom took note of the administration's high-handed discourse and underhanded behavior. Its decision appears to be punitive, leaving me and my family in a difficult situation, without income, a home, or health insurance. It also comes on the heels of Israel's devastation of Gaza, which resulted in the death of over 500 children. People were already tuned into Palestine. Other reasons. The University of Illinois is a good school with a distinguished history. It's supposed to be above such Bush League actions, though its history says otherwise. The presence of institutional racism on campus, from the not really retired Chief Illini Weck to declining black enrollment, has caused much frustration to become more explicit. In short, people working in academia are fed up with administrative intimidation, with implicit and explicit racism, with trustee interference, with eroded academic freedom, with lack of shared governance, with neoliberal structures. My firing includes all of these concerns. It is a flashpoint for administrative misconduct and faculty grievance. I don't think we should overlook the sheer arrogance with which the Board of Trustees has conducted itself. When James Montgomery, the only trustee to vote in favor of my appointment, finished an extraordinarily moving speech about his experiences of racism, board members responded with ill-advised and unfunny jokes, among other instances of boorishness. Ali Abu Nima, the journalist, caught system president Robert Easter in a flat-out lie. The board and the chancellor can't seem to get their story straight. Watching my own firing happen publicly on the internet was surreal, but not just for me. Anybody who tuned in could see how the corporatization of academe functions in real time. It was a pitiful performance whose racism wasn't quite submerged enough to call tacit. I think more than anything, the egregiousness of UIUC's decision illustrates that the furtive codes of campus repression have become less necessary. Academe has never been free. Universities don't like to be openly repressive, however. There are countless mechanisms in place to ensure conformity to the imperatives of the powerful and wealthy. These mechanisms regulate tone, content, action, and access. They constitute and co-opt reward systems and pervade both the notion and practice of merit. They will become unnecessary only when campuses become openly dictatorial. UIUC took a significant and unapologetic step in that direction. Other universities recently have made similar moves. Upper administrators, like most politicians, seize any pretext to consolidate power, whether it comes from pro-Israel lobbying, donor pressure, or conservative outrage. We are entering into an era in which repression can be formalized rather than informally maintained through common sense and consent. If boards and other upper administrators can simply decide without faculty consultation or the inconvenience of shared governance who is fit to teach and research, then the paradigms of higher education change in ways that contravene the very purpose of the university. I have no nostalgia about our academic past or of the utility of free speech in American society as a whole. Rights have never been comprehensive. But with this new paradigm, academic freedom won't even exist in theory. The business people who occupy governing boards will subsume intellectual pursuits to the fiscal interests that motivate any other corporate entity. Please bear in mind that members of the UIUC board admitted that in a meeting, a student representative read aloud some of my tweets. And within the space of 10 minutes, the board decided I was anti-Semitic and that therefore they couldn't have me on campus. This is remarkable. First of all, it indicates that I was indeed fired for the content of my political speech. More important, the board ignored a plethora of university bylaws regarding the hiring and firing of professors. It completely abrogated the work and vision of the American Indian Studies program. And it consciously damaged the university's ability to function normally based on a desire to appease donors. They accomplished all of this under the guise of multicultural valor, that is, protecting the campus from intolerance or discomfort. Please also bear in mind that board members have zero qualifications to evaluate my teaching or scholarship. They've never taught college. They know nothing about indigenous peoples, American Indians, the Israel-Palestine conflict, Arab Americans, Palestine, the Middle East, Pacific Islanders, military occupation, native nationalism, literary criticism, hermeneutics, critical theory, decolonization, scholarship, journal publishing, peer review, university presses, departmental service, advising, grading, curriculum, or how to compose a solitary footnote. How exactly this makes them qualified to make hiring decisions on behalf of the American Indian Studies program is a mystery, but they're quite certain they're capable arbiters of academic hiring. Questions arise about funding, but they all have an easy answer. It's always in some way about funding, isn't it? Always. If you crunch the raw numbers, though, it's clear that the university doesn't receive a windfall from those quick to complain about criticism of Israel. Steve Miller's largest gift appears to have been $500,000. Other donors who complained cited figures of a few hundred thousand. This is chump change to any huge research university. The value of the Zionist donors isn't merely about bank balances. It's about respectability and the unquantifiable value that accompanies it. Siding with Israel isn't necessarily about making money. It's about political ambition, conformity, establishment bona fides, state power. In other words, maintaining the status quo. It's about keeping power consolidated among the elite. It's about not setting the terrible precedent of allowing the colonized a say in their own futures. Political capital coheres and can never be precisely measured by supporting the preferred position of the elite. There's rarely risk in siding with the powerful, but never is there dignity in such a choice. Academics themselves are often complicit in restrictions on our freedom, so I don't think it's helpful to create a firm distinction between faculty and administration. The distinction should be made around faculty interests and administrative interests. One needn't be an administrator to supplement administrative interests. For this reason, I hope we complicate academic freedom even as we vigorously defend it. For example, contingent faculty have no functional academic freedom. They can be fired for unpopular speech without much recourse. It's not just finances that compel administrators to rely more heavily on untenured labor. It ensures a power balance that strongly favors the administration. The government has long relied on the private workplace to stifle speech rights, whereas one, hypothetically, cannot be imprisoned for speech. One can be fired by private employers for it, a mechanism of plutocratic control. It's a further entanglement of state and corporation, and a further entanglement of corporation and university. Academic freedom is not impervious or unchanging. It must constantly be reinvigorated and reassessed. Structures of inequality have always influenced how academic freedom is perceived and practiced. The rights of campus governance usually skew in the direction of convention. One way this happens is through unexamined commonplaces of language. Scholarship, for instance, is never supposed to be political. Well, what does political mean in this context? Basically, fighting injustice. Scholarship and scholars are supposed to be above such trifling pursuits. We demystify the things we study, but we don't participate in them. We explicate, but we do not manipulate. We are like the film crew of a nature show. We document and explain, but never intervene when one animal devours another. To be called political is immediately to become suspect among one's colleagues, to be marked as radical, another term with its own history of coerciveness. Serious scholars can never be radical. Let's look at the term most relevant to our current situation, civility, which is a reboot of the long-standing canard of collegiality. I believe that civility, although it performs the same coercive function as collegiality, is far more insidious and threatening. Before I explain why, though, a quick overview of how something that sounds so innocuous, even desirable, is in fact repressive. I've mentioned informal modes of repression. They're not informal in the sense of being random, but of being unauthorized or extra-legal. All industrial democracies rely to some degree on informal repression, what Chomsky called manufacturing consent and Gramsci before him termed hegemony. It's endemic to universities in particular because the conceits of shared governance and academic freedom must be delimited without open suppression, though open suppression happens plenty. Hence, collegiality is a measure of performance. It is a sprawling and subjective word, which is precisely its utility. I'm not going to attempt the definition because I consider that to be a pointless enterprise. Let's instead examine how its ambiguity facilitates conformity to majoritarian sensibilities. Valuable ideas disrupt, reorder, undermine, confront, subvert, unsettle, upset, menace, admonish, forebode. Critical thinking is fundamentally incompatible with conformity, which is collegiality's primary desire. Collegiality largely performs two functions. It can be used as a pretext to punish somebody whose work is stellar but who doesn't fit in with colleagues. Here, the severe problems of race, class, gender, sexuality, and culture should be obvious. And it can name unconventional scholarship as inferior because it doesn't recycle established ideas and methodologies. Collegiality is the etiquette of submission. It's impossible to be collegial when challenging the common sense of corporate dominion, no matter how politely you state the criticism. Now, collegiality has given way to civility, which creates a new set of challenges to academic freedom. The usefulness of the term as a silencing mechanism is apparent by how many upper administrators have embraced it. Its basic function is identical to that of collegiality, but it more explicitly evokes colonial violence. The very act of using uncivil to describe supporters of Palestine or any other site of decolonization is a terrible irony. The accusation locates the subject in the wretchedness of subhumanity, but implicates the speaker in centuries of colonization and genocide. Remember, I was hired in the American Indian Studies program. I still shake my head that the powers that be decided to rationalize their abrogation of academic freedom and faculty governance by invoking the terminology of New World colonization. It actually puts me in mind of George W. Bush calling his war on Iraq a crusade. And it's another reminder that there's no appreciable correlation between intelligence and authority. I shake my head, but I'm not surprised. Calling my sort of discourse uncivil isn't just a gaffe. It's a conscious statement of institutional values of neoliberalism, which requires dogged political supervision. Colonization is central to the conditions of neoliberalism on and off campus. The university's actions are a deliberate attack on the fields of American Indian and Indigenous studies and on ethnic studies in the humanities more broadly. As throughout American history, natives are an inconvenience to a grander democratic vision that cannot be realized without violence and that erases the elements of indigeneity that it cannot appropriate. The assumption underlying every justification of the administration's decision is that indigenous peoples cannot make autonomous decisions. They require the oversight of their more sage and responsible superiors. It's a perfect allegory of federal Indian policy, only it's not actually allegorical. A final word on civility. Even if we reduce the term to the crude, coercive context in which university administrators deploy it, something we should never do, those administrators still end up on the wrong side. Cheerleaders of civility have been utterly vicious throughout this affair, which always happens when Zionist groups target scholars and students. Palestinians and their allies face barrages of racist invective and verbal abuse to go along with the more civilized practices of microaggression and character assassination. I can't tell you how many people have gloated on my Twitter page about my having been fired, wishing all manner of harm upon me and my family. The advocates of civility are particularly nasty toward women of color. A white male told Jody Bird, a Choctaw, good riddance after she'd expressed concern about the administration's actions at a public forum. Christopher Kennedy boorishly dismissed Ojibwe Jeannie O'Brien in a much circulated email, suggesting that her only useful contribution would be silence. Somebody told a Palestinian student activist that he wanted to make lots of Muslim babies with her. I could go on, but I don't need to. People of color are fully familiar with these sorts of indignities, which do not emerge from the civilized world so much as they define it. On the other hand, the kindness and generosity of the uncivilized has been stunning. There are hundreds of Arab stereotypes, one of which, in my experience, is entirely true. We express love through food. I've been offered more to eat since my firing than Attila the Hun's army could consume in a year. Really, you know, just. In fact, folks of all backgrounds have offered unbelievable hospitality. People have offered money, homes, encouragement, acupuncture, You know, yoga via Skype, you know, you name it. It's been, in a word, love. Unfiltered, undiluted love. If this is incivility, then I ain't never going to learn which fork is for the damn salad. Civility isn't a state of mind. It's a regime. Let's look at an apparently trenchant word, students. The administration is doing everything for the students, right? Never mind that students have been rigorously patronized and infantilized, but which students are administrators purporting to help? Let me point out two things. One, that the students in this instance aren't communities of actual human beings, but an invention of university management. And two, that it is the most privileged among the student body who are beneficiaries of the administration's magnanimity. Students of color, queer and transsexual students, low-income students, students in the margins. Management never includes them in its deliberations. They are useful only insofar as the conceits of multiculturalism can foreclose real democratic participation. No matter how much tuition these students pay, no matter how much they contribute to the vibrancy of intellectual life on campus, they can never be students quite as authoritatively as their normative counterparts. This is a problem of access and representation on many campuses. UIUC is happy to feature American Indian Studies in its diversity pamphleteering, but is much less eager to support even nominal acts of departmental sovereignty. Students on the margins, in fact, are constantly made to justify their existence in the elegant spaces of academe. Take the oft-repeated contention that Jewish students would be uncomfortable in my classes. I leave aside the assumption that discomfort is somehow inimical to a useful education, and the qualifications of Gentiles to decide who is or isn't Jewish. I would never wish on Jewish students even a hint of acrimony toward their ethnic backgrounds. One reason why it is so discomfiting that they are homogenized as proto-Zionists in this characterization. I oppose the policies of the State of Israel. That's the extent of my engagement with Jewish culture, which is to say I have very little engagement with it at all and don't feel particularly invested in it. If people feel attacked on a cultural level when somebody condemns a nation state, then that's a problem of ethno-nationalism, not of political critique. There's nothing in my record as a scholar or teacher that indicates even a scintilla of anti-Semitism. I go on record again to say that I detest the phenomenon. But take any Zionist ideologue, and there are many of them running classrooms. They support, at least tacitly, ethnic cleansing, military occupation, displacement, home demolition, ethnocracy. In short, a profoundly undemocratic state whose violations of human rights are well documented. How are Palestinian, Arab, or Muslim students to feel in one of their classes? It's not just an oversight or disconnect we're dealing with here. It's a profound structural problem of disparate power based on ethnicity and religion. In my case, an imagined hostility devoid of evidence is enough to summarily fire me. But in the case of the Zionist instructor, the support of racial violence is actually real. The fact that nobody ever asks about the comfort of the Arab or Muslim student in the first place illuminates how deeply ingrained Zionist violence is in the mythologies of civility and responsible pedagogy. It's always the marginal, the undesirable, the wretched, who must justify their humanity to the majority. The structural violence of the normative, meanwhile, gets to define itself as benign. Why, anyway, must folks who have never uttered an anti-Semitic statement constantly make our opposition to anti-Semitism explicit? Nobody else has to proclaim opposition to things they've never endorsed. More important, why don't those who repeatedly disparage Palestinians ever have to answer to their troublesome beliefs? I'd love to see folks who condone the slaughter of children and the illegal settlement of foreign territory disavow themselves of anti-Arab racism. It's because Israel, like the whiteness it epitomizes, is the default norm of civility. Israelis are assumed to be human. To criticize them, then, is inherently aggressive. Palestinians, on the other hand, must loudly denounce aggression at every imaginable moment in order to be considered human in the first place, even as we suffer the unrelenting violence of Israeli colonization. Our barbarity is atavistic and imminent. It precedes our subjectivity, restricts our earthly presence, and marks us as inferior. We can achieve the lofty status of pitiable only when we grovel. We constitute a species that must genuflect in order to earn the trust of those by whom we are conquered and defined. I'm no anti-Semite. I say it clearly. I now await my detractors' proclamations that they consider Palestinians worthy of respect and equality. Two events over the past year have brought these matters into sharp focus vis-a-vis Israel and Palestine: BDS and Operation Protective Edge. Let's start with BDS. For those who don't know, it stands for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. It's a nonviolent form of resistance to Israeli colonization, initiated by a call from Palestinian civil society. In recent years, it has become a crucial element of organizing around Palestine. A number of religious, educational, civic, corporate, and activist institutions have endorsed BDS in recent years. I urge you to give it a look and learn more about it. Academic boycott, which is one facet of BDS, has lately generated great results, as numerous scholarly associations have pledged to adhere to the call from Palestinian civil society, most notably the American Studies Association, whose boycott resolution last December inspired widespread debate. I've been a vocal proponent of BDS and academic boycott for many years, and wrote a number of high-profile pieces in support of the ASA resolution. BDS has the attention of major pro-Israel organizations and the Israeli government, which has devoted considerable resources to opposing it. Netanyahu discusses it frequently. It has inspired legislation. And a significant portion of last year's AIPAC conference explored strategies to contain it. As a quick aside, as a grassroots movement with no formal leadership and no external funding sources, it's impossible to contain. As to Operation Protective Edge, Israel's bombing of the Gaza Strip this summer, it resulted in largely terrible press for Israel. The sheer violence and brutality of the assault were beamed around the world, which led to intensive criticism of the Israeli government. Images of dead infants and toddlers flooded social media. Even mainstream news outlets that normally sanitize Israeli violence covered the invasion from a more critical point of view. The campaign isolated Israel more than ever before. In recent months, I was terminated from a tenured position. Megan Marzek, the student council president at Ohio University, has been serially harassed for condemning Israel, including upper administrators at OU, whose only responsibility is to stand by the speech rights of their student rather than entertaining baseless accusations from professional trolls. Bruce Shipman, an Episcopal chaplain at Yale, was fired for anti-Semitic remarks that in no way endorsed anti-Semitism. In September, the AMCHA initiative, a group devoted to getting professors fired, more or less, that's how I would distill their purpose, released a list of 218 scholars it deems inadequately Zionist. And Brant Rosen, a rabbi critical of Israeli state policies, resigned under pressure from his congregation for daring to condemn Operation Protective Edge. One organization devoted to tracking such incidents has recorded over 200 complaints of harassment from pro-Israel outfits in the past year and a half alone. I submit that in order to understand these phenomena, we must remember BDS and Operation Protective Edge. While it's always been a staple of Zionist organizing to exert pressure on institutions to discipline and punish the recalcitrant, there's something distinctly grievous at play here. I don't know that, empirically speaking, there's been an uptick of instances of Zionist repression in the past year, but it feels like there has been. It seems worth considering what gives rise to that feeling. Israel is losing the PR battle, the proverbial hearts and minds. Its supporters, in turn, are lashing out with the sort of desperation endemic to any strong party in decline. They are punitive and belligerent in the absence of honest debate. This is about undemocratic power reasserting itself, refusing to cede even a word to Palestinians in a deeply compromised public discourse. It is, simply stated, colonial paranoia. This should be easy for anybody to see. If your first impulse upon encountering a viewpoint you dislike is to punish the speaker, then you tacitly confess that your position has no merit. Anybody not stuck in the dogmas of ethnocracy would consider re-examining that position. Zionism, of course, is not merely stuck in the dogmas of ethnocracy. It embodies them. And now civility is spreading through universities, quickly settled on the North American continent. Administrators love the word. It means anything they want it to mean, and always implies something sinister without having to justify or explain. The term perfectly encapsulates the sheer force of panic that pervades the elite when they need to find an effortless way to hamper debate, which is usually inimical to their interests. No argument to be made? No problem. Just shut the entire thing down. This is particularly troublesome when it comes to faculty governance. Do we want experts in their fields in charge of hiring? Or do we concede that difficult task to the Simon Wiesenthal Center? By the way, the use of the term civility, just as the organized campaign to repress Palestinian voices, comes directly from the strategic vision of groups like Hillel and the David Project. Their handbooks for pro-Israel activism are online. Give them a look. The U of I administrators are like bluntly allegorical characters in a political novel. They are following that handbook to the letter, right down to the language they're using. If you want to support me, support the people of Palestine. Support natives still dispossessed of land and resources. Support African Americans brutalized by the police. Support anybody subject to systematic state violence. My having a job changes nothing. I'm merely a symbol of the stark imperatives of the wealthy and well-connected. We all are, really. Unless the system changes at a basic level, everybody is merely buying shares in a neoliberal corporation with the power to dissolve our interests the moment we become an inconvenience. Let me close with some information about Operation Protective Edge. In the span of less than 2 months, Israel killed over 2,100 Palestinians. 519 of those Israel killed were children. 475,000 Palestinians in Gaza were displaced to shelters. Israel destroyed 17,200 homes. Israel damaged 244 schools. Israel repeatedly bombed hospitals and UN shelters. The inhabitants of Gaza suffered severe food and water shortages and had to subsist without electricity. 95% of Israelis supported this barbarity. Only 3-4% described Israel's actions as excessive. We're not talking being opposed to the operation, just those who considered the firepower excessive. In fact, 45% of Israelis described the level of firepower as insufficient. There's one thing I remember most from these episodes of unmitigated brutality: the ice cream freezers. Nothing affected me more. Few things better exemplify the gaiety and innocence of childhood than rummaging through boxes of frozen confections. During Israel's bombing campaign, however, the ice cream freezers weren't stacked with popsicles and sorbet. Instead, they stored the bodies of dead children. The symbolism is endless. Ice cream and children's bodies. They usually intermingle in messy harmony. This time, though, the bodies had replaced the treats. The children had nothing to imbibe. Their corpses were on display for a much different sort of rummaging. They were in ice cream freezers because morgues had run out of space, a problem not only of warfare, but of overcrowded neighborhoods and geographical entrapment. Gaza's lack of electricity threatened rapid decomposition. The children rested atop one another in containers that likely provided some of their happiest moments when they were alive. There's nothing poetic about this juxtaposition. It's a terrible algorithm of combustion and confinement. Thus, I tweeted. The evidence in my case is clear. I'm no anti-Semite. I'm no terrorist. I'm no bully. I'm no savage. I'm a man who was fired because I condemned Israeli policy in language appropriate to a horrible occasion rather than in the meek platitudes of civility. I prefer moral clarity. After all, there's nothing civil about dead children in an ice cream freezer. Thank you.